Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nicole Corrado, Professor of Political Sociology at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the University of Canberra, Australia, and co-host of the channel. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Risa J. Toha of Yale NUS College in Singapore. Risa is the author of Rioting for Representation, Local Ethnic Mobilization in Democratizing Countries, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. The book examines the conditions that inflame ethnic riots after the fall of authoritarian rule, as well as the factors that allow violence to subside. The focus of the book is on post-1998 Indonesia, but the insights put forward provoke reflections on many other experiences around the world. I'll repeat that. The book examines the conditions that inflame ethnic riots after the fall of authoritarian rule, as well as the factors that allow violence to subside. The focus of the book is on post-1998 Indonesia, but the insights put forward provoke reflections on many other experiences around the world. Welcome, Risa.
Thank you, Nicole. It's really great to be here.
I'm glad this finally happened. I'm so excited to talk to you about the book. So let's start with a puzzle that you set out in the very beginning of the book. You told us the story of Ambon in the Maluku province and Maluku Tenggara, a neighboring district. And these two areas have very different experiences of ethnic violence after the ouster of President Suharto. So tell us what you learned about ethnic violence by studying these two areas.
Thank you, Nicole. Well, one of the main things that I came away with from studying the two administrative units in Maluku, Ambon and Maluku Tenggara, is that essentially ethnic violence is not inevitable in ethnically diverse areas during political transition. A lot of the insights in political science have basically said that political transitions are rife with tensions, especially in countries with a lot of different ethnic groups, because ethnic groups are trying to secure their position in the new government, and because of a fear of and uncertainties of what is going to happen to them in the new government. However, when I look at both Ambon and Maluku Tenggara, what I find is that these two administrative units are actually relatively similar on a lot of different dimensions that people often associate with the outbursts of violence between groups. Ambon and Maluku Tenggara are both ethnically and religiously diverse. They have similar levels of economic development, even though Ambon has higher levels of GDP per capita. They're also relatively distant from the center of the capital, the capital of Jakarta, Indonesia. They're both in the Maluku province. Yet despite these similarities, there's one very key difference between the separating these two administrative units. And that is the role of the local leaders during the during the tensions and during the political transition in the 1990s. In Ambon, based on what I have learned from my interviews and what I've read, local leaders can have actually been reported to be very directly involved in framing and also in mobilizing violence. Whereas in Maluku Tenggara, local leaders are more seen to work very hard to quell violence by relying on local ethnic networks and local adat traditions. Almost nobody in Ambon believe that violence in Ambon was spontaneous. Instead, different people that I've spoken to said that, well, you know, it seems very hard to say that, you know, not that nobody else is knows that that events are developing and that conflict is being prepared, and that clashes is oncoming. Whereas in Maluku Tenggara, incidents are not a surprise either, because political actors in Maluku Tenggara have witnessed the developments in Ambon, and there have been anticipation of things spreading to Maluku Tenggara. But instead of local leaders in Maluku Tenggara participating in violence and mobilizing more clashes, what people have done in Maluku Tenggara, and at least what people have told me, is that they resort to adat institutions and work very hard to ensure that nobody else participated in violence, such that clashes would dissipate relatively quickly. So in sum, I mean, there's a lot going on, of course, when it comes to the mobilization of violence. But one very key importance is how political leaders in these units actually respond to trigger events and what they do to basically stop and change the narrative such that violence eventually lose its significance.
I mean, that's such an important point. You make the point that it's not inherent ethnic or cultural differences that drive violence. And I love how forcefully you made the point that it's not about culture. It's about the way the leaders adapt to trigger events and the extent of political exclusion that drives violence. So I guess my question is, to what extent can institutions be designed? So you talk about seemingly mundane and everyday forms of institutions like administrative units in Indonesia, but how much do they actually matter as mechanisms to, I guess, redistribute resources and cultivate peace, right? So what does it take then to have successful institutions in addressing the issue of political violence?
Thank you, Nicole. I'm so glad that you mentioned that one of the things that motivated local leaders and shape how they react to trigger events is whether or not they see that political institutions within their area can actually accommodate their desire for greater representation. In Ambon, my book argues that political leaders in Ambon find that existing institutions, primarily elections, fail to accommodate their demands. And as a result, they turn to more informal means of political participation and to violence in order to articulate their demands for inclusion. In Maluku Tenggara, on the other hand, there's not as much urgency and not as much grievance and sense that local political leaders are politically excluded from institutions. So I guess this is a long roundabout way of answering the question of like, what does it mean to have a successful institution? What is a good institution, and how does an institution avoid articulations of violence or utilizations of violence? Well, in the context of political transitions, one of the key concerns of different political actors is whether or not they will continue to enjoy the goods of the state in the new regime. If they anticipate that the new institutions are going to exclude them from the distribution of resources, from political representation and political decision making, then they're going to maneuver and plan such that their position in the new government will be more favorable. So in that sense, then a good institution is one that can actually ensure that key groups and political leaders who claim to represent these groups will be able to participate in institutions and also be represented and be part of the decision-making process. In one very minimal expectation of this is the effectiveness of elections. How effectively can elections actually accommodate demands and electoral interests of various groups within an area? If the elections are only going to exclude these key groups, then these key groups have to turn to something else in order to, you know, to secure their position in the new government. So the strength of an institution depends on the strength of an election. And in the case of Indonesia, we see that initially elections didn't seem to be favorable for the purposes of those people who have felt like they have been neglected and excluded from politics. But then over time, and actually relatively quickly, elections became much more adept and much more competitive and able to represent the interests of different groups.
Yeah, I very much actually enjoy that account. And I guess to link it to the theoretical aspects of your book, you were talking about Hirschman's work on voice exit on loyalty. And if I'm not mistaken, you conceptualized violence as a form of voice, as you mentioned a while ago. So when institutions of political transition are weak, such as elections, disgruntled people may express their voice through violence. And I suppose to continue this line of argument, the book also argues that once institutions become stronger, violence dissipates. Maybe I am reacting from the perspective of someone studying the Philippines, so all my frustrations are now starting to come out. But I wonder whether you also found that, I mean, I guess the question is, what's in it for local elites, right? What do they gain from strengthening these institutions? I imagine some political elites have something to gain from weak political institutions, even if that means constantly suppressing violence. So what can we learn from Indonesia?
Oh, thank you. So I guess there are different groups of actors involved at different levels of government. And in the case of the Philippines, this is because it's also similar, it's also decentralized. There are central political actors, political actors at the central government, and there are also local political actors in the local governments. In terms of institutional design, electoral systems are not... There's only so much that electoral systems can be redesigned by local political actors. But to the extent that electoral systems are fixed and designed by the central political actors, the national level political actors have all the interests to ensure that their electoral institutions are actually strong and able to accommodate different groups in political institutions. Now, whether or not these designs are actually then enforced at the local level, and how much penalty there remains when there are questionable actual practices at the local level, that's an open question. And for local elites, we have to assume that the mobilization of violence is a costly decision, and it's a costly action. And that it would be easier to rally people to vote and to win elections through the official means than to actually mobilize violence and then to pay the penalty and the consequences of being involved in violence. Now, this means that for the central government and the national level political actors, there has to be a system of one, not only ensuring that elections are capable of reflecting the interests of different groups of people, but also that there are penalties associated or imposed on people who are seen and proven to be guilty of mobilizing violence. Because if violence is costly, then you know there's not going to be as much incentive for different groups of people to engage in it. But then for local elites, they can actually also stand to gain from a strong political institution. To the extent that political institutions actually are secure and stable and reliable, they can ensure that there would be a repeated interaction, and they can hope that, okay, once they're elected, they can hope to be reelected, which I guess is a difference. But for this to happen, the national political actors have to already determine the context of what is possible for Indonesian political actors at various administrative units.
Right, fantastic. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about research methods. And I think it was in your acknowledgement section where you mentioned your first fieldwork experience in a post-conflict context was during your time as a consultant for, was it the World Bank Social Development Unit in Jakarta? So I guess my question is, what do you think are the similarities and differences of doing fieldwork as a from a social development perspective or a practice-oriented perspective versus doing fieldwork for academic purposes?
I think what the big difference, I'll start with the differences first and then I'll move on to the similarities. The big difference is that there is a very strong focus and strong a great urgency for how do we fix things when I went on to the field with a number of people from the World Bank. The people that we met, because they knew we came from the World Bank, the things that they revealed to us, while they contain information about the process and the development of violence and whatnot, but the emphasis was more about what the village or the community actually needed. It was more about, okay, so this mosque is destroyed, or you know, we need a well, or we need this, you know, a new road, etc. So the articulation of the themes and the topics of the conversation lean towards, the pressing needs of the community at the time. We had to gently remind people, okay, well, we also want to understand who are the different groups of people that are involved in the clashes and you know, how did the conflict actually develop and whatnot, to be able to get a better background and better understanding of the specific incidents that affected this community, each community that we met. But it wasn't natural for the conversation to lean in that direction. Whereas for an academic fieldwork purpose, because I went in basically by myself with the company of one or two friends that I already knew from prior work, and I didn't come with the big name of the World Bank and whatnot, so that means that not as many people wanted to speak with me. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is I also had to explain many times, you know, why I was there and why I was interested in talking to them. And I was also more mindful of the fact that, you know, I didn't really have much that I could bring in terms of material, you know, benefits or resources. I was really there actually to just hear their stories and understand, how conflict developed in their community. So that's a big difference. I felt like I was more of a, I guess for lack of a better term, an intruder, and I was very humbled by how generous they were, the people that I met with, shared their time and their experiences with me. Now, in terms of the kinds of conversations that I had during my fieldwork for my dissertation and for this book, it was much slower, I must say, because I kept thinking about the list of different theories that I had in mind, that I had developed ex ante prior to arriving to the field, and then thinking about the various implications that would confirm or disqualify different theories. And so as my interviewees were speaking and I was taking notes and whatnot, I had a running conversation in the back of my mind of, okay, what does this mean then for this hypothesis or that hypothesis? And oftentimes I had to actually go back to the same group of people, the same interviewees, and check, okay, is this really what you meant? And then after I have, you know, worked out more fully, you know, the implications of different theories, you know, after the conversation. So it was a much more iterative process. It was much slower. And then I felt, and to be honest, much harder, because I had to go back to my notes and think about, okay, this might not necessarily actually confirm what I thought. And then, you know, I have to come up with a different explanation. But
So the voice exit loyalty framework, was that a framework that emerged after the fieldwork as part of that iterative process, or did you enter the field with that theoretical background already?
So I entered the field with the understanding that political transitions are often, you know, violent. Because that's a generally established and accepted insight in the political science literature. The exit voice and loyalty framework, that's actually something that I stumbled onto much later in the development of the book. So even long after the fieldwork and after the dissertation had been written and submitted and whatnot, As I was writing the book, the manuscript, I thought, okay, how can I actually think about this and express this in an elegant way that encapsulates all the different considerations that political actors in these different administrative units were probably thinking about. And So it's not that, you know, my interviewees in Ambon or in Poso or in Maluku Tenggara are saying, oh yeah, we want to exit this this administrative unit because we feel like we have no hope and whatnot. So that framework is something that I found discovered later that actually seems that elegantly captures the dynamics that's going on.
Oh, that is certainly inspirational, especially for people who are doing their dissertations or writing a book, who are grappling with such complex data, but the frameworks aren't really speaking to that data. So thank you for sharing that. If I may also add, I mean, one of the features of the book that I really liked is how you really focused on the local. And I think the book demonstrates the significance of studying the local instead of focusing our gaze to the highest levels of government, especially during political transitions. So perhaps you can say, I don't know, a few words of encouragement to our listeners about the value of focusing our analysis on the level of districts and municipalities. So I guess, as I ask this question, I have reviewer two in mind, the nasty reviewer of books and articles, who usually say that, you know, your case is so small. What big ideas do small cases offer?
Thank you. Oh, that's wonderful. I've had many reviewer twos in my life.
Right. Shout out to them.
So I completely understand where you're coming from, Nicole. I think there's a lot of value in focusing on the micro and the local level dynamics. I even think that, you know, my focus on the districts and the municipalities might not even be local enough. I mean, you could always go farther down. Like, you could look at the sub-districts, you could look at the villages, you could look at the individuals. I chose to focus my analysis on the districts and municipalities because, at least in terms of the contention and the dynamics and the negotiation for political resources, especially after democratic transition, much of the decision-making and the negotiation and the competition was happening at the district and the municipality level. This is not to say that political actors in the provincial or in the national level are not at all important, or that they do not somehow shape the dynamics. And similarly, or that, you know, political actors in the villages are not important. It's just that this is the arena of competition in the post-transition Indonesia was a lot more relevant at the district and in the municipality level. Now, in terms of what can we learn by looking at districts and municipalities and not just at Jakarta? Well, we can actually see so many different groups of people and so many different administrative units just by looking at districts and municipalities. The number of observations and cases that are available for analysis multiplied by hundreds, because there are, to my last count, at least, but for the period that I analyze in the book, there are anywhere from 300 districts and municipalities in Indonesia through to 543 districts and municipalities. So it's you gain multiple observations, and because of that, you can also see a lot more variation in the dynamics, which means there's more opportunity for testing your hypothesis and thinking about, okay, if, you know, this this particular factor is present, do we actually see the resulting consequence of, you know, the expected outcome that we think we should see? So that's one important value. The second important value I think is in terms of mechanism and understanding what actually lies behind the big argument. You know, how do we actually see political transition producing different types of violence, or specifically in this book, ethnic violence? What is actually happening? And when we look at the district and the municipality level, we can focus our gaze on the specific groups of people and the political actors at a particular district and municipality, and thus understand the motivations and the rhetoric and the interactions and the consequences of their interactions at the specific unit. We can do the same at the national level as well, but again, because there's only one Jakarta, and a group of political actors that are involved in the national level, then you kind of we limit the variation that's at work.
I mean, those are fantastic justifications. So, reviewer two, please understand. finally, Risa, we usually ask our guests in the podcast to give us a teaser of what we can expect from your research in the coming years. You produced a pandemic baby in the form of this book. So, what have you been up to? What projects are you working on right now?
I'm building up on my prior research on ethnic riots during political transition, and I actually now I'm focusing on what do people do and what happens to politics of identity and identity-based mobilization in the post-transition context. So specifically, I am looking at how different ethnic groups and different religious communities express, articulate, manipulate, and mobilize their different dimensions of identity. And what does this actually mean in terms of their attachment, their identification, and their engagement with the national, with the state? As we had spoken earlier, I don't think that ethnic diversity or culture alone inevitably predicts violence or vice versa, or that national political identity can only be strong if a state is ethnically homogenous. So what I'm interested in right now is to understand how do different ethnic groups or different religious groups develop a strong national identification to their national political community. And what does this actually mean in terms of institutional design, in terms of interactions between ethnic groups or different groups at the local level, and also in terms of policy making?
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much, Risa. I enjoyed talking to you about your book.
Thank you, Nicole. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share.
Dr. Risa J. Toha is the author of Rioting for Representation, Local Ethnic Mobilization in Democratizing Countries, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. You've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This has been one of hundreds of conversations about other Southeast Asia-related books on the channel. You can download or stream these interviews free of charge from the New Books Network website or subscribe through your favorite podcast app.